Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have another conversation. We haven't had one in years, though, with Amy Wilentz. Her latest book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She's been writing about Haiti for over 20 years and joins us here today. And Amy, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
This book, having read your previous book and books and other pieces, this book is like, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, it in a sense, because this book was so full of the pain and from attachment.
The pain of attachment. That's a good way to put it. No one said that yet.
That's what it feels like.
Yes, that's what it's like. It's it's a painful relationship, I guess, for me over time, because what happens for a person, I believe, who's learning about any culture that's really different from her birth culture is it's a series of painful lessons and a harsh education. And this has been true of me in Haiti, definitely. And I've learned a lot, not just about Haiti and Haitians, but a lot about myself and about my home culture. And I think after the earthquake, I learned even more about us than I did about Haitians.
I mean, it's also a lot about the people that you've come to be wary of, come to not trust, who you remain trustful of. It's just wandering through Haiti and kind of seeing, in some sense, let me just give an example. I mean, before we even jump into the title, when you talk about Aristide and write about Aristide, to me that was part of the pain of seeing somebody turn in a way that the world didn't want him to turn and you didn't want him to turn.
Well, right. I always used to say to him in my girlish romantic way when I was younger, I'd rather see you in the penitentiary, the national penitentiary, than in the presidential palace. And he was like, oh, really? You know, ha, 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 ha. when he was still a priest, sort of tolerating my Victorian romanticism. But that was obviously not the way he was intending to go. But, you know, people say, well, Aristide supporters say I'm way too harsh on him. And Aristide detractors say I'm way too easy on him. And basically my feeling is, I don't know. No one's proven either case to me. So I continue to walk my line with what I think is the, you know, most Haitian people, which is that still, because he was so repressed and ousted two times and was duly elected two times, that he represents the voice of the Haitian people in some way. And the fact of his silence now is really creepy to me. Not because so much to me it means that the Haitian people aren't speaking, although they're not, but because it means that someone's holding something over his head. I don't know what it is, and I don't know
right.
who's holding it.
But it's almost like when you describe, you know, Aristide coming back from the plane and talking about this nonsense, his heart and his other stuff he was talking about. And that we also say in different parts of the book how much the people of Haiti still love him, especially those who are just sick of their lives.
Right.
Because they still, like many people in America, embody their hope in Obama. Many Haitians embody their hope in Aristide.
Right. Right. That's the thing. Although I will say young people are very different now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the people who were young, very young, in the era of Aristide are now in their 30s. People who were like his teenage and young adult supporters are in their 40s. These are people who are no longer romantic. As you know, when you get to your 40s, it's hard to hold on to any kind of romance, right?
Right, right, right.
So they're not as wide-eyed about him either, his old supporters. And the young people are very different, and they don't really remember Aristide. It would have been like telling someone under Aristide why you supported Duvalier when he started to come to power, Papa Doc. No one would understand. So, I mean, there is a real time lapse now between the romantic ideals of democracy that we had back then and what the Haitian political scene has devolved into.
And I get that sense when you, the part in your book where you were talking to Murtha and Toto, the Jean-Dominique, and who work very close to Aristide.
Right, not Jean-Dominique, but different people.
Yeah, different, I'm sorry.
Oh, you mean about Jean-Dominique.
Yeah, about Jean-Dominique, yeah, right.
Yeah, and they were very close to Aristide, and they had many detracting things to say about him that I'm sure they're sorry they said to me.
Because now they're in a book.
Because so, now they're in a book. And although Aristide will never read the book, he will be told the contents of the book that are about him.
So one of the things you said, before we move on to something else, you said about Aristide at one point in the book, very early in the book, you called him Hades' best hope.
Yeah.
As if you kind of still think he may be. What does that mean? If can he still be that?
Oh, no, he can't be that. He's not allowed.
Right.
It reminds me, you know, it's a little bit like Michael Manley in Jamaica, who got schooled and came back and became pro-business, et cetera, et cetera. But Aristide couldn't learn the lesson properly or wanted power in a way that wasn't manageable by the elites in Haiti. I don't really know what went down. And I'm sure there are people who do know what went down and they are not going to say.
But now, see, that's part of, to me, this. There's many subtexts in this book for me. And one of them has to do with power. Whether it's the power
within Haiti. Right, who has the power?
Who has the power? And it's almost as if, you know, you saw things 20 years ago, seeing it through younger eyes.
Right,
and
right.
What you're seeing now in a different sense of what power means, both in terms of power, the Haitian power on the ground, the power within Haiti, and also the external power that's always coming into Haiti.
Right, and one group I know who doesn't have the power right now, that's the Haitian people.
Right.
And then I know one group that does have the power, that's the outsiders. And by that I don't mean even the hugely powerful and often misguided recovery effort of outsiders. But what I mean by that is the people who conducted the Haitian presidential election that brought Michel Martelly to power, if you can call what he does power.
Well, clearly you have no respect for this last election.
I have no respect for this last election, no.
So going back to the beginning, in the very beginning, pardon me, in the very beginning of the book, where you describe to your readers before you even start the book about why you chose not to use the word vaudou, but use the word voodoo.
Right.
Which we can talk about. But also this whole, the Fred Voodoo piece, and there's some great, I mean, it's really, I think, really important to understand what Fred Voodoo is and what you have to say about that. I mean, that he is, I think, as I paraphrase something you wrote in the book, that Fred Voodoo is a, here it is, I said, no one in Haiti was not Fred Voodoo to a foreign correspondent, to a wide-eyed missionary, to an exhausted development worker. Fred Voodoo.
Yeah. Well, Fred Voodoo, I learned this term from a couple of British correspondents during the fall of Baby Doc Duvalier. And I would come back, it was my first foreign correspondence job covering that. So I'd come back to the hotel where all the foreign press was, and I was exhausted and everything, and the Brits would say, "Oh, well, did you talk to Fred Voodoo then?" So what's Fred Voodoo got to say? And this was their not very politically correct way of talking about the Haitian man in the street, as if you or I were to say Joe Sixpack.
Right.
And but for me, Fred Voodoo has a resonance, which is he's kind of this cipher into which outsiders pour all their stereotypes of Haitians. Obviously, not every outsider in the world has any idea about Haiti, but those who think they have an idea about Haiti, they're thinking about Fred Voodoo. And he can be a Haitian tailor, but he can also be the president of the country, and they're still thinking about him in somewhat the same terms.
In a very condescending way.
Yeah, pity and condescension.
Right, pity and condescension. But for you, the Fred Voodoos, for want of a better term at the moment, that you talk with, I mean, there is a sense of what people in Haiti really yearn for after the fall of Duvalier, and even in the camps after the earthquake, and even now with the IOM and all the other groups with their kind of schemes to get people out of those camps, you really touch on the sense of the anger, frustration, and sometimes acquiescence of the Haitian people.
What I try to do in the book is say farewell to Fred Voodoo and
right.
say each of these people whom I'm talking to and showing you in this book, each one is his own individual, a real person with hopes and desires that might even mirror your own. So that's one of the things I'm doing. And so I try to do a lot of thought experiments in the book and put the reader in the position of the Haitians and say, now you imagine yourself in this camp. Excuse me. Now you imagine yourself in this camp living on, you know, $2 a day with your family. And you imagine what you would hope for from your government and from the outside recovery effort. And that's a much harder thing to do than to lump all the Fred Voodoos together and say, well, what they need are square box cement block houses out on some arid stretch of moonscape outside of town with no commerce and no culture and no history.
That was because when you described the camps, I mean, what you just described now, you described the camps in the book is at least there was a vibrance. The culture was there, and once they moved out,
they were built by Haitians,
right?
So they had Haitian habits and things that outsiders actually probably don't find very attractive, like tiny little alleyways, and they're made of cardboard and tin, and they're just like a Haitian shanty town. A lot of these camps, although I must say, the ones that have been depopulated now were the better, bigger camps. And the little camps now, I don't know, the ones I visited very recently, they're so horrible that I couldn't accuse them of being vibrant.
I mean, reading the book, I just keep imagining, you, you know, and trying to keep yourself in some ways, as you describe a few times, emotionally detached. But clearly, this is a very hard place for you to get to.
Well, actually, I have quite good survival skills and emotional detachment. In fact, I think I have very old-fashioned reporter's detachment, frankly. I mean, I don't get too much post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't. A lot of my younger colleagues, they get traumatized, apparently, or they now know what it is or something, but I never used to feel that. I used to feel like, okay, let's see the next thing. Okay, let's see the next thing. And I sensed after the earthquake, I could feel more my own emotional attachment to Haiti, you know, because when you see something you love that's ruined, it's very disturbing. So I was eventually disturbed by it, but I really try to maintain that kind of clinical detachment going through everything. It's too much. If you don't, you'll just fall apart. And you can't fall apart if you're a reporter and a writer. You have to keep on having your eyes open. You can't cloud them with tears, you know.
No, I understand. I understand. I there's also the complexity of the people from the outside. I mean, the white folks who come in, and you're kind of, I've always had my own issues with people in the development world. As I've covered them over the years, but you really kind of pin it in a way in this book, except for a few who really kind of get it and try to live and hear what the Haitians are saying and be part of that.
Right, but it's very, very hard, weirdly hard, to spend a huge amount of money in a country that's this poor. There's not the capacity on the ground to spend all that money. Huge, huge amounts of money were raised by organizations to help with the recovery effort in Haiti, and then these people realize, oh my God, we don't know the country, we don't know how to deal with this place, and now we're going to just shovel all this money into it. And they really didn't know what they were doing. And I think, you know, everybody attacks the recovery effort for having raised so much money but not having spent so much money.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that they're not wiser to just hold that money until they figure out how to spend it. I mean, they're not using it for something else. Although what they've done with the recovery effort has been very questionable to my mind, but at least don't just go about doing it more, you know, because you have more money. So there are a lot of things about the recovery effort that are very complicated, and I tried to convey them in the book. But one of the things that really always would drive me crazy is just the sheer ignorance of the people who were doing recovery work in Haiti, and obviously this doesn't mean all of them. And ignorance doesn't mean that you're not a good, kind person. It just means you're ignorant. And often you can be ignorant without knowing you're ignorant. And I'm sure the UNICEF people who came in did not think they were ignorant, but they were ignorant. And there was this sense also in the recovery effort. And I speak of it in the past tense because a lot of it is moving out because it's hard to keep fundraising when an earthquake is 3 years behind you. But a lot of the problem with the recovery effort was that it was, in my mind, tinged by racism. So that, you know, if you went into Italy, say, after an earthquake to do relief and recovery work, you wouldn't have no-go zones. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I won't go to, you know, Rome.
Right.
That's too scary.
Right.
No, it's partly racism and it's partly fear of what poverty is. They don't know what poverty is and they fear it. So they live these kind of compound lives. This really clever journalist who spent some time there named Rowan Garrity, he's a development worker too.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a wonderful article that I quote in the book called The Compound Life.
Right.
And it describes very acidly and accurately the kind of life that the recovery effort people led or lead in Haiti, living in gated compounds, which is where it takes its title, only fraternizing with those Haitians who were in the business community or contractors, you know, people of a fairly elevated level, but not with the actual people they were trying to help. You know, going out to these nice restaurants where I have been, you know, I don't just eat spaghetti with the people when I'm in Haiti either. But going out to fine dining and, you know, staying in hotel suites and only being there maybe for 3 weeks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really know what you're doing if you live that kind of life. And you're not allowed by the rules of your organization into almost exactly those places that you're trying to help.
I think that as you talk about some of the relationships that Haitians have with outsiders and the white gods of the past and some of the white gods of the present, it's a complex relationship.
Yeah. A friend of mine told me after he heard me talking about my book the other day, he said this thing that's so profound to me that I can't really say on the air, but I can give you an indication of what it is. He's mm-hmm. My friend's an actor, a stage actor, and he's among actors, and I had never heard this, or you can bet it would be in my book, among actors, that as the audience is applauding them and they're taking their bow, they mutter an expletive about the audience under their breath. Like,
right.
It's a combination of, you're applauding me, I fooled you, you believed my emotion, I don't have it, you know? It's so like how Haitians often feel about the outsiders who are helping them. Isn't that a great thing?
I love it.
Thing?
That's great.
I love
That's
that.
Great. That's great. It would have been in your book.
It would have been.
Yeah, because you do in your books, you really write it as you see it and put it out there, even yourself.
Well, my biggest attempt with this book, and I really felt it and in a way that you don't usually have this feeling when you're writing a book of nonfiction, even though it's what you're doing, but my attempt was to tell as much truth as I could get at, whether emotional, political, historical, but just to say it. You know, it's my book and I'm going to say it. I may be wrong, and many people are yelling at me right now, but, you know, I said what I thought.
They're yelling at you, you think, because why do you think they're yelling at you?
Well, one thing is, and I feel this very strongly, and I think they're right to yell a little bit about this, I don't want to be part of the Republican narrative, the right-wing narrative that says, oh, we can't help these people. Oh, we throw money at them, and they waste it, and, you know, they're corrupt. I don't want to be any part of that. I don't want to be a part of a narrative that says we should no longer give foreign aid or that we no longer have to help in relief and recovery and natural catastrophes around the world. I think it's a great impulse. From any country to any other country. But I just want it to be, you know, a way of reaching out a hand in brotherhood and equality, if there's any way to do that. And the one way to reach out inequality is to know each other. But so, if you don't know each other, you can't really help each other.
So how do you think, this is not, well, a little outside the book, sort of. So how do you think that the world should react to Haiti? And how does it help? How does it become involved. You talk about, you know, how the Clinton-Bush thing, they're there, but they're gone.
Well, it's kind of how the State Department has changed since there's been terrorism originating in the Muslim world. They've eliminated all their specialists in Arabic, and they've eliminated all their specialists in Islam, or at any rate, under the Bush administration, this happened, Bush 2, or as we call them in Haiti, Baby Bush. but I feel that that's what's happened in the recovery effort, that there just aren't people who know enough about Haiti, and even when they are, they're not, you know, they're seen, as perhaps many people see me, as nuts. Like, you must be crazy. Or stop telling me about that. Or don't try to explain voodoo to me. That's not part of what we're doing here. Or whatever. You're just considered some kind of eccentric whackhead if you know too much about Haiti, and they don't want to hear it. And I think that happened in the State Department over Islamic terrorism. And I, you know, I think it's unfortunate. You have to know who you're dealing with before you can do anything. Negotiate, help, control, anything.
So there's a couple of things you do in this book. A couple of chapters really, a lot, this whole book got to me. I mean, I thought, you're a great writer, so it's easy to read the book. But clearly throughout the book, your angst in view of what has happened is really ragingly clear.
I don't want to be part of it. That's the thing.
No, exactly.
And I do feel myself a part of some bad thing about Haiti, and that is that, to be honest, you know, for more than 20 years, I've been making a certain amount of money off Haiti. That since the earthquake, I've been making about an eighth of my income off writing about 300,000 dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Without their deaths, I wouldn't have written the book, obviously. So I feel weird about the debt that I owe to the country, and how does one repay that? But I'm trying.
No, you are. And that's right. I think the book, I mean, is an important one in the recent books that have been written and the articles that have been written, just because of what you expose about yourself and about your thoughts and analysis through that. And I think that there's a couple of things. One was you have these really interesting pieces in the book about Vodou and about the Vodou priest who you knew and knew well and spent time with. I think Edgar Jean-Louis.
He's in there, yes, among others.
And you write about, you really, with great respect, talk about Vodou and then also talk about the werewolves and that whole world.
Right, the folkloric world that surrounds Vodou, yeah.
And when you, and I can't, well, maybe this is crazy, but I'll say it anyway. But to me, then, I was juxtaposing that to the chapter you wrote about mining.
Yeah.
And this clear division of what is, in some ways, at the heart of Haiti and what is being taken out of the heart of Haiti.
Yeah. The mining thing is really, really scary to me. Haiti's
really
not
scary.
A very big country, you know?
Right.
I think it's the size of, like, New Jersey or something. It's like, small. The mining companies, they're all outsider companies, of course, with great expertise. Gold mining and then also other precious metals like copper and silver. Apparently Haiti has in plentiful amounts. And they now have not title to, but they have contracts that allow them to explore mining in 15% of the territory of Haiti. So that's a huge amount of territory in such a small nation. And it's really, they're not that trustworthy. There's this guy who used to be head of the Bureau of Mines in Haiti. And he was kind of summarily kicked out in order for the Haitian government to sign these contracts with the mining enterprises in what I consider an act of gross corruption. He was kicked out. But before he was kicked out, he said, look, if Haiti has a good government and the mining companies are honest, this is a great thing for Haiti. And I read that as like comic writing, because of course what he meant is Haiti doesn't have a good government, hasn't had a good government, and mining companies are never honest. So it's not going to be good for Haiti, and in fact, it won't be good for Haiti as it's constructed now, as it's being undertaken now. This is the gold mining companies mostly.
Right, which has, as you wrote, this horrendous record around the world.
Oh, very bad. This
is
Newmont Mining. I hate to malign them. I'm sure that they are trying to be as good as a mining company can be. But they still have a very bad reputation in many countries. And, of course, mining itself, especially gold mining, is rapacious for the environment. It's a terribly polluting enterprise.
And, as you write, Haiti is not getting its due. It won't get its due with this.
Well, because he wanted to uphold the 50% tax on revenues, I think it is, for mining that Haiti had insisted on in the past, which is why there are no mines in Haiti. And Newmont and Eurasian Mining were having none of this. So they changed the rule. So now they can come in. And now Haiti won't get what it would have otherwise gotten.
So, Amy, I'm curious where you think you go next with Haiti. What do you?
Nowhere. Thank you. Can't I be done?
You can't. Are you done?
I don't know. Well, look, Madison Smart Bell wrote a trilogy, right?
Yes.
Do you think I have to write a trilogy then?
No.
One for each of Madison's books?
But it'd be a very different trilogy.
Well, right. His is fiction and mine is nonfiction.
Right.
Ostensibly.
I will
say ostensibly and ostensibly.
Well, I hope there's one more in here.
Oh, I don't know.
We'll see what comes next.
Amy
Malenz, Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. It's always a joy to talk to you and a pleasure. Thank you so much, and thanks for all the writing you bring to us.
Thanks a lot, Mark. It was fun.
We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. We're going to hear a new episode of Soundbites. We'll hear about how we got to the place in America today with all this industrial agriculture. What's its history? We'll hear about an educational farm that's at risk of being shut down and learn about the health risks that children exposed to pesticides face. All of our children. Don't go away.